and welcome to Redefine, your home for news about parental school choice and education reform.
So you turned a lot of heads with a piece that you wrote a couple weeks ago for the Fordham Institute. I guess I'm wondering, critics of the private school choice programs, one of the things they've said is that, you know, what the people in the school choice movement are really about is they're all about universal vouchers, and whatever they say, that's what they're really about. And so was part of your goal in sort of coming out here to sort of challenge people within the movement to say, don't let these critics be right?
The point I'm trying to make is that a coalition of people came together to push for parent choice, you know, 20-some years ago, at least in Milwaukee. And that coalition always involved people who wanted universal vouchers. And the point I'm trying to make is every time that issue came up in any meetings that I was in, I always told people that the moment you all start pushing universal vouchers, that will be something that I will oppose. So when critics say that there have always been people in the parent choice movement whose goal was universal vouchers, that is true. But there's also people in the parent choice movement who've always been opposed to universal vouchers, and I'm one of them. Many people always felt that people like me were somehow being duped, that we really didn't understand that that was the real goal. And I would say that I've always understood that. You know, various people come together and their interests do converge at a certain moment in time. But it's also true that those interests won't necessarily be linked forever, because the people who are compromising don't necessarily have the same worldview. And so they come to that compromise from very different places. So the only way we could have avoided that would have been to say, we're not gonna have parent choice for low income people. You know what I mean? Because you couldn't get to where we got to without pulling together the type of coalition that was pulled together. I feel it's incumbent on someone like myself to make my position clear, whether that position prevails or not.
On that point, I want to get into some of the responses that people have come out and said to what you've had to say, which they've said, well, programs like the one in Nevada, what they should do is they should have a weighted funding mechanism where you have more funding for the more disadvantaged students or for the poorer students. Is that something that you think could help sort of mitigate the systemic inequities in the education system? Or
at different points in time, I have supported the idea of a graduated way of looking at this, mm-hmm. if for no other reasons than political reasons, right? Because people have argued with me that if you have a program that's only targeted for poor people, it's very difficult to sustain that program over time. I understand that, but even if you go to a graduated kind of way of doing this, like say to earn tax credit income or something like that, I would still argue that there has to be a ceiling where once you get over this income, you get nothing. You know what I mean? In other words, I could see a situation where you might set up a program where, let's say, people who are 400% of poverty, let's say, they would get X amount. But as you keep going down the income ladder, the people at the bottom would get the maximum amount. But I still think that if you go to some type of graduated program like that, there has to be a max where you say, once you get over this income threshold, you get nothing. And that, to me, is one way of trying to broaden the political support without creating a universal voucher that gives money to people who already got money and who really don't need government money in order to send their kids to private schools.
And in Florida, we're beginning to move into the direction of a graduated program. But like you said, there's an absolute ceiling on eligibility, first of all. And then second of all, there's also a provision where basically the poorest families get to the front of the line and you don't even get into those higher graduated levels until that supply is exhausted. And so I guess what I'm wondering, though, is in Florida, we have a scarce amount of money, and there's a scarce amount of scholarships available due to the structure of the tax credit program. When you start to talk about Nevada, it's kind of a different ballgame, just because there's no limit on the number of scholarships that could be given out. Does that change the calculus, or is your concern more that the idea of giving money to people who already have money?
Yeah, that's my issue. To me, like, I never got in this battle, and I've said it over and over and over and over again. I never got in this to give money to people like myself. If I had kids today, with my income, I've been blessed. I should not be taking money from the government to send my kids to private schools, period. My objective has always been to try to give low-income and working-class people some access to a private sector education. Not because it was necessarily going to be the best education, but I wanted them to have that option. Because for some of their kids, a traditional public school might be the best option. A charter school might be a best option. Or it may be a private school. I just don't think that we ought to have an America where only those of us with money have the ability to access all three of those sectors. And I also don't think that we should be giving taxpayer money to people who have the capacity to pay without getting the support from taxpayers.
You mentioned a little bit sort of this idea of the politics of this, the idea that, and it sounds like this is something you've dealt with before, where people have proposed, well, why don't we expand eligibility to higher income people to sort of build a broader and larger and more powerful political coalition? I mean, isn't there an element here where, you know, a universal program like, say, Social Security, kind of, it really is politically robust? I mean, people are not going to attack Social Security, whereas you look at like something like Medicaid, I mean, that comes under fire all the time politically. And so is there, you know, in some states or in some situations, maybe a political upside to having a universality?
From my standpoint, the answer would be no. I would oppose it no matter what state I was in. Because I understand the argument about Social Security. So for me, the closest thing on the voucher front has been the earned tax credit, which I totally support, and I see how that scale operates. But at a certain point, you get to a certain income level, you don't get the earned tax credit. Because the program was set up to really support people who have less in our society. And that's sort of how I feel about the voucher program. Tell me how poor people would be advantaged by having a universal voucher. And I guess I don't see it. At the end of the day, I'm just over here, and maybe I'm just stubborn in my old age, whatever, but I just don't see it. The reality of it is, when people have the votes, it doesn't matter what people like me think. I just feel like I have a moral responsibility to Polly and to all of us who started this battle initially, to be clear on this point. It's always been an issue of social justice for me. And because I look at this through a social justice frame, I just can't see how justice is served by giving someone like me government money to send my kids to private schools.
Now, so one of the other arguments that sort of come up in this is the idea that, well, so public schools, they serve everybody, and they serve the rich kids and everybody on down. In why should we have means testing in private schools, but that magnet schools, for example, or just district schools are different?
Well, I do think that private schools and public schools are different. I think that when we set up a public school structure, it sort of has one set of rules. It's just like you have a situation where you have a private school statute in Wisconsin and a public school statute in Wisconsin. And I don't think that those statutes ought to be the same. I think there ought to be some different requirements. I think there ought to be similar requirements, but there ought to also be different requirements. And maybe I'm too much of a traditionalist. And maybe what's happening is the generation behind me doesn't make those same, you know, distinctions, you know, that I'm making. And so the argument would be that no matter how rich you are, if you live in a certain area and you want to send your kids to public schools, you can do that. Now, in my view, people have set up enclaves in certain parts of this country where they don't need to send their kids to private schools because they control the public school structure and they got enough money to create a public school environment that would be very similar to what some of the, quote, better private schools would be able to provide. And so I'm not arguing, Travis, and I never would, that I have some, like, sound, waterproof response. For me, it is just a philosophical point that I'm not able to cross. And I don't try to demagogue anybody who has a different view than I do. It's just that for me, that's a bottom line when it comes to providing public dollars to access private schools. I think poor people should get support to make that happen. I don't think people who already have the resources should.
You mentioned, you know, the sort of generational issue. I mean, I think it's fair to say that I'm sort of part of that newer generation, but I think that there's value in the first principle case that you make. I look at in Nevada now, the difference between what a poor family gets and what a low family gets is about $600. And so if a poor family is getting about $600 more, it's conceivable that a wealthier family or a middle-class family could kick in even additional dollars more on top of that out of their own pockets that a poor family never could. And so you start to build a system that is more capable of serving the wealthy and the middle class, the people who have money that they can add on out of pocket, and then who winds up getting left behind is the people who don't have that money out of pocket. And so I think that this is a question that for that reason, this is something that we have to wrestle with as well.
Yeah, I think that's right, Travis. I mean, it's like people will say to me, well, I was in a discussion yesterday at AEI, right? The issue came up about what is the distinction between equity and equality? And it's like when you looked at the historical, like, suits around school finance, and at a certain point, people moved away from talking about equity to talking about adequacy. Because even if you were in a situation where a school district, a resource-privileged suburban district, would get $17,000, let's say any number, the public school system would get $17,200, and people would say that that was equal. The problem, though, is it may be equal, but the level of resources that would be needed to help the kids who are in the urban area might be much more than what it would take to help the kids who are in the suburban area. Plus, because of the way that the system is set up with property valuations as a basis for determining the amount, you would spend the percentage that you could generate because you're in a higher property district, you could generate a much lower percentage of your, you know, taxes, would generate a much larger amount of money because of the way that the system is set up. And so the point I'm trying to make is I'm always looking at the fact that no matter how we try to skim over it, talk about it, intellectualize or whatever, the system is set up to favor people who have more resources. And so somebody, and I'm the somebody, has got to at least sit here and say, hey, you know what? What you all are doing on the surface seems, quote, equitable. But in reality, it's not, because you're further advantaging people who already have an advantage. If we do not fight to make sure that there are programs out here that give poor people a leg up, give them some more opportunity, if we don't fight for that, it's not going to happen. And then when we have the kind of programs like Nevada, what ultimately is going to occur is that poor people will be squeezed further out of the ability to access something that might help their children. And if I'm wrong, you know, 10 years from now, if I'm still around, people can scream at me, or if I'm not around, they can say he was wrong. You know, but we'll see.
So, but I think that really gets us to the heart of the matter, which is that there's this question about resources and who gets them and who has historically gotten them. And I think there's also this question of we might try to debate who's eligible for what or who gets how much money, but it kind of seems like there's really this core principle that I think you're raising, which is there's this question of, well, who's shaping that conversation about who gets what money and who really is driving that discussion? And I guess have the people who were shortchanged by the old system, like, where are they and where are their voices in shaping the new one?
Right. Yeah, because what you really address in terms is the question of power, right, in our society. And the reality is that we know that poor people have the least amount of political power in our society. And we can argue, you know, back and forth about, well, they should do this, and they, you know, and they should. And I've been trying to, you know, will continue to fight all of my life to make sure that people use whatever leverage they have. And it's one of the reasons, for example, why some of the people who talk about they support things like vouchers and opportunity scholarships, but now they're trying to put restrictions on who can vote. My view is that some of this support for vouchers and scholarships is disingenuous, because if what you're also doing over on the other hand is limiting the ability of those families to participate in the process, it becomes ultimately smoke and mirrors.